Welcome to the Space Cave. I am David Huntsberger, your host, transmitting from out here in the nether regions of deep space. Clear your mind, transport yourself wherever you'd like to go, somewhere calm and quiet, and we'll have some libations. If you drink beer, join in and chat with someone smart. And I have transported myself to a hotel room in San Francisco to do some shows at Cobb's Comedy Club with Al Madrigal. By the time this has come out, those will have already happened, so it's too late to get tickets, and I can't let you know how the shows went. Perhaps I was fired immediately, and I didn't even do the shows, or perhaps I was carried out on shoulders, and I didn't even get to brag about it to you guys. Anyway, thank you to L. Charlie Bishop for the beer money donated this week. Always appreciated. Definitely helps. If you'd like to buy the show a beer, it's right there on thespacecave.com, right on the front page, and really appreciate it. So thank you, L. Charlie Bishop. I've been working on some items that I'll maybe put together for donations in the future, because I know most people feel like there's no need, but, you know, eventually I might get a donation that just feels too generous to just say merely thanks, so I'll send you something. And this audio you're hearing, this recording you're hearing is not recorded via Samsung, but I don't know if you saw in the tweet, they sent me a bunch of gear. I just reached out to them to say, like, hey, your headphones are great, and they sent me a bunch of stuff, so in the future, this show is going to sound immaculate. I think it already sounds pretty decent, but, whew, guys, get ready. Samsung is the best, right out of New Jersey. They're real nice, all the folks there, so thank you, and soon, I'll let you know. You'll know the difference. Maybe I won't even tell you. You'll know the difference in the sound quality. Not going to do a call-in this week. I apologize for that. I know that's kind of a norm of the show, and I like checking in and getting to know all of you, but I've been traveling a bunch and just busy. I won't bore you with the details, but I've just been a little bit busy and driving and out of cellular telephone range and computer range a bit, so decided not to do a call this week as I'm just recording in a hotel room, and this has already gone on long enough. Hopefully you'll just skip ahead to the conversation, but I'll tell you a few things that have happened in my life of or recently. So I just found myself feeling like a fifth grader, and I'll tell you what's going on. So first thing, but it does feel like that, the first thing I saw was a high-speed chase. I was kind of stuck in traffic, and this car came flying up on the side in the like the shoulder. And I was like, whoa, that's pretty interesting. That person must have diarrhea. And then, whew, flashing lights. I was like, oh, that, I hope the person just pulls over and explains what's going on. But then I see another cop car come flying up behind me. And I'm just rolling along with everyone, going like 20 miles an hour. And then up ahead, I start seeing cars jockey out of the way as if the fleeing car is kind of trying to make moves. Like, hey, I'm going to cut across six lanes of traffic. And the cars were sort of, just by their car language, were kind of, to me, expressing, like, we can't, dude, we're cars and we're jam-packed. So then the guy got off and left down an on-ramp, and the police cars followed him. And then I was so frustrated to be in this traffic jam that I wanted to speed around just to go watch. Like, don't worry, I'm not a criminal. I just want to see how this turns out. But I kept rolling along at 20 miles an hour. And then when I finally got up to the off-ramp, all the cop cars were already surrounded, and they already had the guy in handcuffs. So I wasn't that, I mean, I was really probably 30 seconds behind what had happened. And in that time, he had overshot the right turn he was trying to make. He was going a little too fast. So he ended up just going beyond the lanes he wanted to turn into and into the lanes where he would have been heading into oncoming traffic. So then he had to just stop and give up. And so what I saw from the overpass looking down was him in handcuffs getting pulled back to the cop car. His look like a 92 Honda Civic, not the greatest getaway car. If you're driving one of those, you might disagree, but if I'm choosing from a lineup, I might not go with that one first. And it was just sitting there pathetically, the driver's side door open, facing oncoming traffic, looking very impotent, like, we gave it our best. And he was, I don't know what happened to him. I didn't look it up online. Maybe he just had some outstanding tickets, or maybe he was some sort of drug kingpin. I'd hate to think that anyone with those terrible getaway skills could be running any sort of crime syndicate or whatever. Anyway, it was interesting. And then today, driving into San Francisco, traffic was backed up. We get up to the scene. I've seen this now a couple times, but this one was perplexing. Usually when you see a car on fire, it's horrific. And this one was, but I've seen them like flipped upside down and emergency vehicles all around and they're spraying water on it. And you go, oh man, I hope the person got out of there. But this one was just a single cop car parked behind, again, like a Toyota Celica, like a mid-90s little tiny sedan car. The front tires were exploded, I guess, so they were flat because they'd been on fire. So it looked like it had been punched down by the thing, like the hood just smashed down, fully engulfed in flames. The entire hood, all the front area, into the flames were so abundant that you couldn't see if there was anyone in the driver and or passenger seat. No emergency vehicles, no fire department crew, and just this one cop car there with a police officer just standing, not even guiding traffic, just watching it like, whew, that's really flaming up. He was kind of lazily, you know, motioning people with his hand, but otherwise doing nothing. So I don't know if he was not a hero and couldn't race up, and maybe he's going to be haunted for the rest of his life because he heard screams. I hope not. Or if for some reason emergency vehicles had gotten there, rescued the person, driven off without even attempting to put out the fire, which is understandable. But who's driving that ambulance that's so fortuitous to just pop on the scene, get in, and then head out? So I think no one had gotten there. My theory at this point, and this is just a working theory, fellow crime solvers, if you have any theories, feel free to weigh in. I think someone was working on their car and put the hood up, and then they didn't fix it, so they walked away. And somehow or another, after that, it caught on fire. Now, was it someone driving by with a flamethrower? I don't know. Was it someone with perhaps some fireworks they shot into the hood? Doubtful. But I'm ruling out that it was someone driving who pulled over without getting into an accident and had their car burst into flames and then died in the car as a police officer just stood there and watched. So I have no idea what happened is the conclusion of that. But it could have been one of those things. So hopefully whoever was driving that car got away fine. And if you park that car there illegally, I hope it burned up all the registration information and you move on with your life. Maybe it was like a falling down moment. If you haven't seen that, Michael Douglas, it's fantastic. Maybe it was one of those moments, just one too many days in traffic. Screw this. I'm lighting this piece of shit on fire and I'm getting out of here. If you did that, good for you. Okay, final story. I was in a coffee shop the other day. The timing was a little odd in that I almost went into it, then I walked up the street a bit, and then I walked back. And in the interim of that time period, like say 15 minutes, things changed a little bit in that I came in, I ordered, and then as I'm standing there waiting for my order, I'd gotten like a little scone thing, and the guy offered me a plate or a bag, and I was like, I'll take the plate. And then he goes, oh, we don't have any plates. I go, that's fine. And then he went looking for a bag. And while he walked away looking for a bag, I see a figure emerging from the side of the coffee shop, and it was wearing a hoodie and sunglasses. And I was like, well, if you're trying to be, what's the word, Clint? What's the word when you're like, inconspicuous? Whew. That was a stretch. I had to pause to think about it. Inconspicuous. So this person walking in, looking very conspicuous because if you wear a hood up and sunglasses. So I look over out of the corner of my eye like, wow, that person looks very conspicuous. That's Eddie Murphy. He's not fooling anyone. That's clearly Eddie Murphy. And then he stood next to me and I told him he was a good guy or something like that. I said he was, that's not important. Anyway, I saw Eddie Murphy and then I ate my little scone off to the side and watched people as they were ordering and whatnot, unaware that this incognito character over in the corner was a Hollywood legend. So it was kind of interesting that maybe that hood and sunglasses method does work, because he seemed to slide in and out of there without a lot of people noticing. When he finally walked out, there were some heads turning like, what? I think that was... But I knew it was indeed Eddie Murphy. So anyway, those are the stories and the what's been going on in my life. Let's get to this episode. This involves a good friend of mine from Austin, Texas. He was visiting town, and he is one of these guys when you go out and hang out with, he just has so much knowledge. He's not one of those people that goes, oh yeah, I read a story. I think it was a, he knows definitively. He really like immerses himself in research and knowing these things. So he's a wealth of information on American history, and particularly the presidents, and not the band, but just presidents of the United States. And I asked him what kind of beer he liked. He said brown ale. So here is me having some brown ale with my friend Eric Krug. Well, I can live with that. No one does get excited. So
perfect.
Well, we'll just see about that today, though. I'll get you pretty fired up. What a proclamation to make.
I'm not planning on being very excited about today.
But what about this delicious brown ale, my friend?
It's good. It's good. I'm impressed that you actually went and got a brown ale. I mean,
sometimes I don't have time, but I was on the way home and I stopped today and got you this... is it called Dare to Dream, or is that one of their slogans for their brewery? I've never had...
It says Rogue. It's Rogue.
The only way I know Rogue is someone made me, maybe from one of these types of bottles. Rogue makes I'm now seeing their what do you call it? Like graphic design is always similar. This one's like kind of a nerdy Walter White-ish looking guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other one I have is like this cowboy dude, and someone who listened to Professor Blastoff, they cut bottles and make them into glasses. Mm-hmm. You have any of those?
Mm-mm.
So I, in my house, have a Rogue cup, but I'd never had Rogue beer. This is my first, this brown ale.
And where's the Rogue cup? We're just not using that?
I might show you later, if you remember after this. Oh, this was something to do with the Great American Beer Festival. Looks like it was rewarded.
It's pretty good.
Hazelnut brown nectar. Do you have a favorite brown ale?
You know, actually, my favorite brown ale was at Red Hook Brewery. I went up there when we were in Seattle, and they had a brown ale that they said they were working on, and they gave us samples of it, and it was absolutely delicious, and then I never saw it go on the shelves. I don't know. Maybe they sell it in Seattle, but everywhere that sells Red Hook, I've never seen it.
They do. We were in Eugene, and Ninkasi Brewery is there, and they said that'll happen sometimes. They'll just throw out an entire batch of beer. Just be like, yeah, did it was close. People liked it.
I thought it was great. I thought it was fantastic. I mean, yeah. I like that. I don't know. I don't know how popular brown ales are, though. I like the Honey Brown and the Newcastle, you know, all that stuff.
There's one here called the Downtown Brown. By, I wish I should probably look that up, what brewery it is. I only know it through that name. I don't think it's Angel City, but I think it's one of the LA breweries. But it's really good. Moose Drool. I've had that on the podcast with Kyle McGinn. Hello, Kyle. It's Kyle. From, I think it's from Big Sky Brewing. I could
Moose
be wrong
Drool
there.
Sounds familiar. Like, it's a, like I've heard about it. Like people are talking about it.
Oh, really?
Oh, it's the words in the street.
It's real good. I think I'm starting to learn more about beer. I like porters well enough. Mm. And these are in that same realm, right? Close?
Yes. I'll be honest. I'm not a beer connoisseur. I like whiskey more than I like beer.
Yeah.
I think I just like whiskey more because, like, I get full. Like, I drink one beer and I'm full. I'm not drunk yet, but I'm full already. And that's the end of the night. So, because for me, the night ends when I'm full, not when I'm drunk.
Oh, so, interesting.
So it's like, I like whiskey because I can drink that for a long time. And then, you know, and then I'll eat something and then I'm done.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I guess I always just think that I'm maintaining a certain level of, like, I'll go ahead and I'll get rid of that.
No, keep it going. Let's just have that interrupt us every 5 minutes.
I don't think it will again, but I'll make a little note. Well, or it can stay in. It can fit. Give it loose.
I love loose. Listen, I'm a loose guy.
Well, I was. It might have been my computer's way of being like.
It's not what I want.
No one really wants to hear your drinking strategy. Why is it that you stick to beers? Well, the thing is, no one cares.
Well, if you were looking to be a better drinker, you know, I got some tips.
Well, mine's the opposite of yours in that I think with whiskey, I don't see it coming, and then all of a sudden I'm like, oh, I'm drunker than I'd like to be. Beer, I can feather that gas pedal just how I like it.
You know, and this doesn't sound, but I do a lot of drinking alone, and so it's really nice to just have that sort of like, I don't really know how drunk I am. I just feel good, and I'm in a chair.
There's no one to go like, dude.
Exactly.
Pull it together.
Yeah, it's when I get up to go to the bathroom, they're like, oh, it's a good thing I'm not in public. That's the end.
You don't strike, you're an interesting guy in that we've had many a conversation. We hung out with each other quite a lot. I don't know that I know where, you're from San Antonio originally? Are you a military kid?
No, not military. Moved a lot.
Okay.
Family's all originally from Chicago area, so that's kind of like where the roots are laid.
Okay.
Born in Omaha, lived in Houston for a little bit. And then by age 7, moved to various places in Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
In the summers, we'd go to Iowa with my grandparents in between houses. And then from Kansas, after my parents got divorced, went back to Illinois to the Chicago suburbs. So I'd say mostly Kansas as a youth.
Okay.
Illinois, Naperville, Illinois as a teenager and early 20s. And then beyond that was like mostly Texas, but I was in the military too, so...
What if I had remembered all of that?
Yeah, you wouldn't. I barely remember it. Iowa also is kind of like a second home too, because like I said, that was like more
consistent. Is it Iowa?
Marshalltown, Iowa.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we went there every summer.
And then you were in the Air Force?
Yes, I was in the Air Force. And then stationed in San Antonio, moved to Austin afterwards. So been Texas for, so actually I've been living in Texas since 2003.
Yeah, we know each other from probably since 2006 or 7.
Yeah.
Austin.
Yeah.
Funny comedian, won the funniest person contest, right?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
2008, like a long time ago.
Way to go, buddy.
Yeah.
And
got a lot of old credits. Got a lot of good old credits.
Those are the ones you need. Listen, from someone who's been on Premium Blend.
Oh, Premium Blend.
Ah, the beauty.
Dust that one off.
Yeah. People still day of. Like, what was that? Oh, sorry.
Mine was the last season of Live at Gotham too. Shut it down. I shut it down for
that. Was supposed to be the hip new cool thing that replaced Premium Blend, but it ended up, I thought it was cool. I liked that show.
Yeah, I actually kind of miss the fact that they don't still do like a show for just sort of newcomers and people that don't have like...
Well, they have Adam Devine's House Party. Isn't that what that is?
Yeah, but isn't he still... I kind of feel like his... I mean, I'll be honest, I haven't really watched it, but I kind of get the impression that it's more people who at least have... already have some street cred in comedy. Like the thing about Premium Blend and Live at Gotham, it was sort of like, this is your first time on TV.
Yeah.
No one's heard of you before, and we're going to see who the new people are.
Yeah, I can speak to that from experience. You can be a complete nobody, and they'll put you on that show.
Yeah, like, you know, like my show had Kumail Nanjiani and Nick Kroll on it, and then it had me.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, Dan Jackson.
Oh, right. Our good old buddy. Pal. Yeah.
A good buddy.
Those are frustrating when you have tangible sort of starting line thing, like, oh, if this is a race, I'm way behind.
Exactly. That's what I think of every time I go back to those days. I'm like, ah, oh, look at all those guys who did real good for themselves. Ah, oh, that's great.
You might be the closest or the most eligible person, and there have been people who are, you know, physicists and things on the show, but in the Air Force, like, that's a pretty critical step to getting into NASA, being an astronaut, right?
Yeah, I was real close.
Were you at all? Did you entertain that notion in any way?
I mean, you know, I think I entertain occasionally notions of doing something more important in the military, but no, I was a total pogue, which is the... like, just the basic, the worker bees who do not... Like, there's...
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Persons other than grunt is pogue, or sometimes called rear echelon motherfuckers, REMF, and it's like that.
Being a pogue or a rear echelon person,
yeah,
do you get near the jets? Do you get at least?
Yeah, well, I was in air trans, so I was basically working on flight lines. Although, like, see, this is why mine was a total Beetle Bailey kind of military experience. because like
I know the name Beetle Bailey, but I don't really know what that's in reference. Was he kind of a
It's like the Gomer Pyle kind of thing where you're just a sort of like scrub and like, you know, you show up with your boots unlaced and my shirt untucked and I'm just like, oh gosh, Sergeant, I guess I'll just go take a smoke break.
And then what do? You go over and mop up the jets?
Run a mop on them? Like AirTrans like encompasses a lot of things. Like it can be like helping the loadmasters load and offload cargo, passengers, manifests. But like where we were, like we had about 12 people in my terminal and the average is like at least like 300.
Oh.
So it's like we had two training flights a week. And training flights are ones that usually our people don't have to work on. So that was it. So I was literally like, I was obsessed with the war in Iraq. And so it was actually kind of fun for me because literally I'd go in and then I would just sit there and read about the war. Like I had like, back then there were a lot of blogs that Iraqis wrote and that soldiers would write. And I would just like, I had like people I followed and I would check in every day, see what they're up to. It's like, well, the school down the street blew up today. And like,
So frontline sort of dispatches.
Yeah. Like actually when I think back on it, I'm like, man, that was kind of cool because I don't feel like you have something like that anymore. Like, I remembered recently I was talking about, there was that incident where like, some guys in Afghanistan had a video of them like peeing on a dead body and it got in a whole lot of trouble and all that. And I remember there was this website where soldiers could post their photos from coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan and they were brutal. And there were sometimes like funny little slogans at the bottom. Like there was one of a guy on a stretcher. I assume he was an insurgent. Or I don't know. But he was just like, the quote was like, you're going to be okay. And it just shows the guy kind of like screaming. Then the next thing shows his legs and they're just mashed to pieces. And they're like, oops, maybe not so much. And it's like,
yeah.
And I was like, man, that would be like an international incident if that website was still up, because I mean some of the things in there were like really, there was like just a head lying in the road like after a tank had ran over a guy or something.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, you could not get away with, like, but I just remember seeing that like online and like we'd be talking about it in the terminal and people like, oh Jay, you seen that site? Yeah, it's a good site.
These aren't like dark websites, they're just the deep web or whatever. Yeah. I feel like now the internet has become, I get on there sometimes and like I'll just do a search for a thing that I think might be an interesting blog and just hope that someone's maintaining it. Like this weird, I like the idea of strange corners of the internet that no one's in. Like, who is this person that maintains a blog that no one sees? And then sometimes I do a search and I find it. And some of them are kind of captivating.
Yeah.
But it seems like people that do that give up and then they lose their rights to it.
Blogs are like a joke now.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think like at the time that was sort of a, I mean, it was almost like the first time to really give that blogosphere a test run because there was something big happening that people wanted to know about. And most journalists were usually too pussy to go outside the green zone. So it's like it was the only place you were going to get people who are actually in the like battled areas telling you what they're seeing. And, you know, journalists just weren't doing that because they were getting killed and shit.
Yeah. And that even when they do give the information back, that was the thing, like you probably saw this too, like when you go to the road or, you know, doing comedy, like there'd always be one of the comedians who would have some sort of take on whether it was like politics or the military or something like that, and inevitably afterward people that were in the service would come over and just be like, you're totally misinformed, like you whatever you think you know, you don't know. But it sounds like you guys, you were like, you not only had knowledge, you had these weird insider blogs that, you really knew, like...
I don't really know exactly what made me stumble, because like I said, I was just obsessed with it. I had nothing but time on my hands, because I was just like, I just got stuck.
That was Beetle Bailey.
Yeah, I did a three-month tour in Iraq, and then there was the time when Katrina happened, and those are like the only two times where I actually felt like proud of doing, hey, I'm actually part of like a mission that matters, and then the rest of the time I was just nothing but time.
Did you like it? Because you're kind of proud of it now, but at the time, did you like? I think people go through this: get in, hate their recruiter, really have like this sucks, and then afterward get out. I mean, not to say like not enjoy it, but a lot of times after the fact, like look back on it and go, I'm proud of that. I'm proud I did that.
Yeah, I think I was fairly. I don't know if I mean I don't because I've never been proud of myself.
Well, of course not.
I was proud of, you know, being a part of the military. I always had a pride in that, but I did not feel pride in what I accomplished in the military.
Where does this come from?
Well, I mean, this is the thing: is like I do talk about, I don't really talk about it too much now because it's just in the past. I tend to like always, get sick of my jokes after a while. But like, even the joke is always that I didn't really do anything, you know, because, you know, it's fair to say that. But it's people who are in the military, I think for the most part, they respect that. And like, you know, they know, like, I mean, I've been around guys who actually were combat veterans, and they like, and we can just joke about it. And they're like, yeah, you're a pogue. I wasn't. No big deal. Like, nobody cares. But it's like, I also think it's a, I think it's good to be humble about it, because you got to, like, I want people to understand there's a difference between what I did and what a, like, what I consider a real veteran did.
Yeah.
And I think it's good to have that humility. I mean, like, most people would just say, oh, you still did more than most people. And I do feel proud of that. But I'm like, but it's still important for me to keep my head in the, you know, not out of the clouds and know that I didn't do, like, real veteran shit. I did just regular stuff. But it's still, I will say it's still a very impactful experience going over there, even, you know, in my limited capacity, and actually just getting to see, because you get to, like, you know, we would help with the wounded, you know, and you'd see the coffins being loaded. There were, like, special forces guys. One time I had to take them out to their plane so they could load one of their guys up, and that's, like, a very private thing at the end of the runway kind of thing. And, you know, and so there's, like, moments like that where it's like, okay, I've gotten to, like, at least witness the effects. So that's an experience that a lot of people don't get to have.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say, more this guilt I feel of being, like, a low-level veteran, that definitely happened much more after I got back. Because then it was suddenly like, oh, man, I am not doing enough. Like, other people are really doing stuff.
It seems like if you worked in a restaurant and whatever position you're in the back washing dishes, and then you say to someone, like, I work at Panano's, and they go, you guys make the best food. Like, you don't need to clarify and go, like, well, actually, I don't make the food. And I, it's like, you're a part of it. And it all helps. It all makes the food come out and taste delicious. And you do need to wash those plates. But I could see where you would feel that way. But that seems like an odd thing to get hung up on. I mean,
well, it's just the fact of knowing that I could do more. Not to sound all fucking Schindler's List, but you know, I definitely feel like there's more I could have done, and I, you know, and it's a weird, it's like, I mean, this is a, I feel like there's many different tangents I could go down, but like, also I joined in 2002, so like, I lived in New York, like, moved there like right before 9/11 happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't like it wasn't like a big deal to me, but it was a big deal. But I didn't really think it was going to be like a real war. I was like, this isn't Pearl Harbor. We're not facing the Imperial Army.
So you weren't Pat Tillman or someone that was like,
no,
this, damn those sons of bitches. I'm going to go do
the very opposite.
So then why join? Were you broke? Were you listless? Yeah. Like, just looking for something in life?
Yeah. Like, cause basically there's no, like, I was in New York for like 5 months and I was like, I'm broke. I don't know. I don't even know what I thought I was going to do here. I got to go move back in with my parents. And my buddy Tom was joining up and he's like, come join with me. And I was like, well, I guess it's that or go back to temp work while I live at home. Yeah, let's go join. that was
the weird thing about that to me, and this, I want to talk about this at some point, because your knowledge of American history, and particularly the presidents, is fascinating to me. But that your family is politically at least interested, maybe not active, like,
I mean, just, it varies, obviously.
But it seems like the people that were aware of the weapons of mass destruction being kind of a smokescreen and things, like, you seem to me like someone that would be not only ahead of that, but also aware of the names of different members of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
Yeah,
and
I did like that stuff, yeah.
So that, like, you're aware of the inner workings much more so than most people, and still going like, I want to join the military.
Well, one, I would say that really my political awakening happened in like 2003, 2004.
Oh, okay.
That was like a big thing of it. But I had like something, because I was like very obsessed with World War II and the Holocaust when I was a teenager. I was a very fun guy as a teenager.
Drinking like, alone, just thinking, paint a weird picture.
Well, I didn't drink until I was like 20s. Like, I didn't really do anything. As a kid, I was very straight-laced. I didn't smoke or drink or smoke pot even. But I was very morose, and I enjoyed dark subjects. And so I always had kind of this... So there was always the seed of that, like, I would seem, at least internally, I would have the personality for somebody who would... 9/11 happens, and I want to be Pat Tillman. Like, I'm going to go get this, because this is my Pearl Harbor moment. Oh, this is, like, the moment I dreamed of, like, all my life that I thought my generation would never have.
Yeah.
I always thought my generation was so boring. Nothing... We mattered... We didn't matter at all. Just shit generation. And I couldn't care less about it. And then 9/11 was like, oh man, this is the big to-do. But I had always had this notion that it was like, these guys just got lucky because no one was paying attention. They're never going to get lucky again. Afghanistan will be over in a month. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you go back in time prior to Iraq, it kind of looked like that was all coming to fruition. So when I joined as 2002, I mean, maybe people were starting to talk about Iraq, but certainly I wasn't in tune with the news enough to know that it was like a real thing. Because growing up, it was like people would talk about, yeah, we got to go get Saddam, but everybody's like, yeah, you're just saying that, and then you're going to make a resolution, and then you're going to do nothing.
Yeah.
So I really like, and again, it was also because like I was going through training at that time, so I wasn't really as big into the news and history stuff. Well, some history, but like not that stuff as much as I am now.
Yeah.
So I really was like, I had already kind of made up my mind. It's like, yeah, they're going to talk a good game again. They have to because 9/11 happened, so they got to go back to, like, you know, beating their chest. But they're going to just, you know, let it go again. So when we went in, like, I remember the day we first, like, he put the 48-hour ultimatum up and then, like, launched. And I was like, I was actually kind of, like, proud, like, of Bush in a weird way. I was like, damn, you meant it. All right, go, dude. Like, I was just like, I thought you were just going to pussy out like everybody else did.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, like, how I initially felt.
And then what was it like to, well, and then, sir, like, why the Air Force? But what was it like when you do join and you're there to see, not like the walls tumbling in, but just, oh, this isn't what I thought. Like, we the strikes happen and it's like kickoff to war.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're in 4 years. So
yeah,
over the course of that so 4 years.
2002 to like, 2006.
Incrementally seeing it get worse every single.
Yeah.
I mean, that's got to be crazy.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's like, I mean, I'm trying to like go back in my mind, but yeah, like I said, initially there was a kind of excitement, and I will definitely say this though, I think I had a very different perspective than most people did at that time, and so it gave me a little bit of a unique perspective. And I've always tend to been try to be a consummate moderate. I'm always the guy, like, if a liberal friend and a conservative friend are arguing with each other, I try to referee and be like, well, can you see his point of view? Oh, can you see
yeah.
his point of view?
I like that about, like, because you're a guy that I have very few of them, but I'll ask when everyone's freaking out about, I was doing a tour and just kind of asking everyone at the end of the shows was like, what's up with this Trump thing? And you're one of the people I would call and just be like, I trust your sensibilities on this. That even if you didn't have a dog in the fight, you would just go, well, here's how it's trending. Here's what the numbers mean. Here's how historically this is patterned out or whatever. So I don't know how that necessarily ties in to the war and all that, but
it's, well, I mean, it's like trying to remain the neutral party, but sometimes it's hard. Like, I'll admit, like, Trump's like, well, and I don't really detest conservatism the way a lot of my friends might, but, like, I will not just sit there and rip on Republicans because it's trendy. Like, especially on stage, like, it's much easier to make jokes about Republicans
than sure,
it is
yeah.
liberals and stuff. But I don't like doing that. But I will have no qualms about making fun of Trump. I'm like, I'm sorry, this is just retarded. It's just retarded.
And that's what a weird word to use that would put you more, you're defending conservatives.
He is a retarded. I cannot.
Whoa, hey. I got, damn it, now I got to make a note. I can't have that in there. What are you doing to me?
Oh, man. Hey, this is Trump's America. I'm just trying to live in it, you know?
You're doing a good job. Let's back
okay.
up a bit.
Okay, let's back up.
Because so, you're an interesting study in that, and there are plenty of comedians that are conservative. Now, I'm not saying you are, but understanding the military, understanding different areas of the world, you know, it's easy to be like, well, I'm liberal. Like, of course you are. You're from the Bay Area. Yeah. You know, you were raised around that. It's hard to know what the, and I feel like that is in the stupidest, like, Pollyanna-ish way, what the country is suffering from. Like, people out in rural areas don't see inner city people,
yeah.
and people there
yeah.
don't see them. And there's this huge disconnect of, like, what is it like? I think I know. I've seen the news. I've got a good idea of, and it's horribly misrepresented both ways.
Yeah. It's very, yeah, I mean, it's weird because my friends and my family is much, I love them and I love, you know, hearing their opinions and stuff, but they're also in a weird way, kind of a sociological experiment for me too, because it's like, oh, let's see, why do people, like, I'm always, and I'm analyzing myself the same way. I've constantly tried to be like, let's say I actually could run for office, which party would I be in? And I keep going back and forth. I'm like, I don't know. Like, I really don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And
because people are kind of clamoring now for, which I think you would appeal, and this is me just broadly saying, like, someone that understanding the conservative side of maybe like the fiscal side of things and more of a liberal sort of, well, I mean, you can be gay, you can,
yeah,
you know, those.
That's why I liked Goldwater so much. Like, when I finally like learned more about Barry Goldwater, like, this is an interesting thing, and this is like one statement about my politics that might just make people be even more confused, but like with history and stuff. My now big four that I really seem to always really like, but I think sometimes I just like personality wise, but is like Abraham Lincoln, Eleanor Roosevelt, Barry Goldwater, and Malcolm X. I don't know what that says about me, but those are like the four people I've always been very drawn to.
That is just, I mean, just that you know them, that you're familiar with historically, because obviously people saying Abraham Lincoln, it would just be like, well, I mean, we all kind of know the high notes.
Yeah.
But you know, knowing how he, you know, how he ran his campaign and how he acted, you know, behaved in, not behaved is the wrong word, but how he put things into action when he did, you know, take office. That, to me, most of my, like, history buff friends, that's the most appealing stuff about him.
Yeah. And it's, well, and I mean, I was talking to another friend of mine who's also kind of nerdy about presidents. And I had to admit, like, I don't even think really I'm that big a fan of Lincoln's politics. It's just, I like him, like, I relate to him, because he was kind of a morose guy who used humor to, like, you know, hide the fact that he was always sad. And, and like, and I mean, it's more complicated than that, but it's like, he's an interesting, like, story. And also, I'm very, like, I'm somebody who gets kind of cynical about life just being a big ball of crap, but I
you're cynical about that, or you think that?
Yeah, I find that I keep, like, getting disappointed. Like, I mean, Iraq, like, I had high hopes that at least the mission would work in the end, and then it just turned into this big mess. Arab Spring happened, and I found that same resurgence of, it's going to be okay, the people are going to, yes! And then I'm just like, oh, this is crap again. It's like, that's what always seems to happen.
So you have, just to cast generalizations, you have a big heart. There's probably a part of you is your, in my mind,
I want to be a believer.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. But I'm always disappointed. And then I'm like, no, I'm an idiot, not a believer. And I feel like Lincoln's story of just like somebody who really wanted to like leave his mark on the world and do some, like, I mean, that's one of his big quotes is like, I just want this world to be a little better for my having been in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then just like, by like almost like a trick of fate, he ascends to the presidency because he was a nobody. Like, it should have been Seward.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets to the presidency and he gets to oversee probably the most traumatic era of American, like, to basically the make or break the country and to abolish slavery, which is like the one, like, we can argue about taxes, we can argue about healthcare, but that is a clear cut good and evil fight right there. And he got to be on the right side of it. And then to, like, you know, just that sort of tragic end to it, which in a weird way is almost kind of like happy to me, because Reconstruction was such a mess that I almost feel like he should be happy he was spared seeing what happened after the Civil War. So it's just like, it's an amazing story to me. And it's almost like, as fucked up as this sounds, it's kind of what I would love to see happen in my life. Like, I would love to see fate use me for some purpose and then just shoot me in the back of the head. Like, I would love that. I'm just like, oh, you got to live the dream.
So you're searching for, I mean, that's got existence, to get into that a little bit. You're aware of, like, I'm here, this could just be a one-time thing. It's certainly not shameful if I just go to a simple job every day and come home and drink by myself and watch television or read a book. And I could live 100 years and do that and then go, eh, that was as worthwhile as anything. But there's maybe a part of you, like, why we like those books where you, the chosen one.
Think, oh, absolutely. I will not be ashamed to admit at all that I am secretly hoping somebody will pull me out of my doldrum and be like, we need you to save the world.
You've always been the one.
But I try to keep myself at ground level and be like, you know, that's probably not going to happen. But I'll, you know what? But I'll be ready. I'll keep, you know, the suit pressed just in case.
Yeah. Like, but is it, with like Abe Lincoln, you think it's kind of a martyrdom thing, or you think he had that thrust upon him and just, wow?
No, because he wanted it. I mean, well, I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I think, you know, I mean, he definitely was, like, he's very ambitious, and he, like, I mean, politically he could be very partisan, like some of the stuff I don't like seeing today. I mean, he was very big on attacking his opponents, especially early on. He was very, had a very acid tongue about it.
Oh, really? I thought he snuck through between Seward and
Well, that's more later on. I mean, he was very politically astute, and he was good at it, and I think, like, and he did have, like, I think he was more moderate in his own personal thinking, but, like, on the outside, when he had to write articles for the Whig Party, because Illinois was a very Democrat state, so he was one of very few Whigs there, and he was very good at attacking people, and they knew that about him, because he was the quicker wit and, you know, a little sharper, so they kind of, like, used him for that.
I think comedians would all respond to that. Yeah. To just, like, he was just so clever, like, just quick-witted and had good anecdotes. And
it's interesting hearing the times, too, when it didn't work out and he got slayed by somebody. He's like, oh, big got me. But, I mean, yeah, I think he also regretted it a little bit. Like, they talk about some of his, like, you see some clips from his letters and stuff where he kind of regretted being so nasty to people. Because he almost fought a duel once, which a lot of people don't know about. I mean, if you're, like, a history buff, you probably heard about it. But there was this guy, James Shields, that challenged him to a duel for some nasty stuff he wrote. And the thing about the dueling is you kind of like, you have to at least humor it. Otherwise, you lose, like, you know, you lose face.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but this is great, though, and this is quintessential Lincoln. So what he did was the guy he was dueling was known for being an excellent shot, but he was like almost a foot shorter than Lincoln. So the person who gets challenged gets to choose the weapon. So he chose sabers because he had like his arm length was like way longer than that guy's. So the guy backed out of the duel at the last minute.
So that guy lost face.
Yeah, well, by accepting the challenge and meeting at the ground, and then there's like kind of this, it's one of those things where like picking up the check where there's always a charade you have to go through.
Yeah.
So the seconds will like meet each other and be like, is there any way we can talk you guys out of this? And the guy is like looking at the swords probably and like, sure, you can talk me out of it. Damn it.
It's like the guy who, as long as his friend is pushing against him, is scratching and
clawing. Yeah.
Just hold me back. Hold me back.
Well, if we could talk, you can talk me out of it. It turns out I don't like swords. I did not know that. I'm one of those people who had no idea that Abe Lincoln...
And he felt very ashamed. Like, actually, people would bring it up to him, like, when he was president and stuff, and he would get, like, red and feel very uncomfortable. He did not like talking about it. He felt very bad about it.
Just embarrassed that it's like, why... I mean, we're so civilized now. Now, yeah. Go pee outside.
I mean, but that's an interesting... This is what I love about history, too. Those are questions that you don't really have a firm answer to, because since he didn't like talking about it, he never, like, sat down, this is why I'm ashamed of it.
Oh, sure.
So it's, like, one of those things where we all, like, history buffs can just sit down and be like, what do you think about it really bothered him? Like, and you might have a different idea, and you're never going to know the exact answer, but it's something you can think about.
If you had some people to drink with, you could really get into that.
If it wasn't just me talking to myself.
What do you think, fellas? No one's here.
What do you think, right hand?
So I think you're paying. So then the your childhood into the military, then so when it does end, you leave kind of a bit forlorn, kind of like, mm-hmm. Well, we didn't accomplish anything. I didn't accomplish anything. Nothing was ever thrust upon me. Like,
yeah,
you got to take this, and this is your moment in life. It just kind of shuttled you out. Like, no need for you anymore.
I have a tendency to just sort of follow whichever way I'm being pushed. You know, I've been lucky in that I probably could have just fallen to pieces
at
any moment.
Abe Lincoln. I just kind of go where they push me.
I fell back up for a second when we were my stance on the war when it started was a little weird because it was like with, like you say, weapons of mass destruction and stuff. I didn't really care like if they were there or not. Like, and I remember that being the big topic, but I was kind of like, yeah, that's not the point to me. But I
can sympathize with that because it became such a big deal that it wasn't there. And yet I think if Bush had been able to articulate more, maybe people would have gone like, yeah, either way, he's still like testing chemical weapons on people.
Yeah.
Like that's been proven, right?
Right. Yeah. Okay. I think the mistake that like they made, and probably the same like thing that I didn't think of, is that perception matters. Mm-hmm. It's like sometimes it doesn't even matter what is actually happening. It matters what people think. Like ISIS is a good, like, people make fun of Obama for calling ISIS the JV team. I kind of agree with him, but I think history is going to prove like both of us wrong on that score, but I still don't think that means I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. Like, because I kind of feel like by us thinking that they're bigger and better than they are, we've made them bigger and better than they are. Because a group like that thrives on notoriety. And by thinking of them this way and making them into the big bad wolf, they've become the big bad wolf.
Yeah, so in like a way, their numbers still going up.
Yeah. Like, I mean, nobody would be flocking to like join them in like all these, you know, disparate communities if it wasn't for the fact that you're hearing about them in the news, like ISIS is the next big thing. It's like, they are. Well, I gotta go do something.
Yeah, they're getting their brand out there.
Yeah, they're really brand heavy, and like we're really just helping them with that. And like, and if we didn't, I mean, because they're not like a big military force. They can't, like, you know, they're never going to like take over Saudi Arabia or take over.
So what? I mean, you're someone that I would go to. I don't keep up with it. I don't know. From the beginnings of all of it, I mean, so many things, like Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, Hezbollah, well, like the everything involving the West Bank and the Gaza Strip,
I come in and out. I mean, that's the problem is like, and this is the thing which I think is just, everybody's just got to be really humble. Like, that's, I don't care if people say they don't know, and I don't care if people have an opinion that disagrees with me, and I just hate it when people are so arrogant about, like, thinking they know. It's like, there's no way you can. There's mm-hmm. no way you can. Like, that year, 2004, which is the year I went, which is the year I was spending every day, and, like, when I was in Iraq, I actually got to read the SIGINT bulletins every morning, Which is basically like the stuff that Bradley Manning like released, or Chelsea Manning. I don't want to get in trouble.
Yeah.
But like those were the same things that my sergeant, he's like, he'd be like, yeah, you want to, I know you're into this stuff. Go ahead and you can read them in the mornings. I mean, I had the secret clearance, so it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't top secret or anything. So it was like, I was getting all
it's
that.
Like medium secret.
So I'm getting, yeah, it's, yeah. And you know, I had a clearance for that. It's mm-hmm. fine. But it's like, it was, you know, getting all that information in and getting those perspectives from people who were there and stuff. And like I said, even like, you know, you could hear more from Iraqis, I think, could speak up more in those. It's like, even if you're someone like me who was literally gobbling it up 24/7, you're still gonna, you know, you still can't possibly wrap your head around all of it. Plus, it's not every, it's, it depends like where you're at, what part of the country you're in, what time you were there. Like, cause I missed like 2007, like late 2006 up to like 2009. I kind of just like, I got so bummed out by it that I'm just like, I'm not gonna think about it anymore.
And it pulled you back in.
And then, you know, and then I got more interested in it and I kind of like.
Well, it's like I mean, if you're a sports person, you know, I think to know all of it, you'd have to be alive the entire time and have an unbelievable ability to recollect all the information, even the subtle little things to say, here's everything that happened and here's where, because sports to me is the same sort of saga. It's a soap opera essentially that people argue on and go, this is what should happen. But you people draw back to, they fired the coach at this point and that's what made this happen. That put this in, and you go, you know what actually happens? This guy rolled his ankle. It was kind of an innocuous thing, but that led to this, that led to this, that led to this, that led to the coach doing that, where then they had to fire him. But when all those, and that's just in sporting. I mean, that's in something right. that's totally inconsequential. So to think that the amount of weapons and bombs and bad looks yeah. and whatever else gets thrust in there that changes people's attitudes towards one another as a culture, as how could we possibly know yeah. every little ingredient?
Yeah, you just become a sage if you guess right. That's what ends up happening. A bunch of people make predictions. One of them's going to turn out to be right. And then everybody's like, that guy saw it coming a mile away. And he was like, I was just taking a shot in the dark. I don't know what the hell's going on.
Mm-hmm. Same as in sports. You know, in 2015, they're going to be pretty good.
I said Marco Rubio was going to be the nominee. But if he pulls out something in the last minute and wins, I'm going to look like a fucking genius.
That's true, yeah. Well, here's to hoping.
Here's to hoping. I mean, today's the day, or tomorrow's the day, actually. Like,
well, this will probably come out way, way down the road. I mean, who knows when this is. This is kind of a nice time capsule that, or it may be infuriating. People listening, oh, they're so naive. They only knew.
I definitely didn't take it that seriously at first. But I'm taking it seriously now, folks.
Yeah, you've got to be. I mean, because you say you get out of stuff. You leave. I leave it and then I feel so ignorant and so dumb that, like, if I get invested in politics, it makes me feel terrible.
Yeah.
And so I just
like,
kind
just of... Just because you feel like you don't get invested enough all the time, or...
Because then I feel like you're, like, not to say, like, how the sausage is made, but you kind of realize how ineffective it is and you are within it, and then just how maddening it can be. Like, why would someone support someone who said that a child born out of rape is an okay thing? That just makes me so mad that I can't deal with this. Like, I just trust the general American population and I kind of stay back.
I think
just
that's what
touch.
Most people do, and that's why it's like this.
Yeah, exactly. It's such a horrible catch 22, or like it's a.
Well, I've never voted for a president. I mean,
not even Obama.
No. I generally like. I kind of feel like I should have, but it's sort of one of those things. Like, and it's bad to say, but I mean, I lived in Texas, and so I was like, well, I already know where my vote's going. So that doesn't. So I don't really get that motivated.
I had friends in California the same way. Like, he's gonna win here. Like,
And I had no doubt he was going to win in 2012. Like, you know, my family was surprised by that. But I was like, nah, I can tell you guys are going to blow it again.
Well, my premium blend, let's bring it back to that, W. Kamau Bell was on it. And he was talking about Senator Obama and saying how unbelievably unlikely it would be. Like, his whole bit was about how, like, his name's Barack Hussein Obama. You know how he would be better off being named Blackie Blackerson. And then it made me feel really good when he won. Like, proved that very logical bit totally inaccurate.
I always liked him. I just, I don't know. It goes back to that whole thing about trying to figure out where you place on the political spectrum. And it's always never going to be completely accurate. I do think, especially being in the military and, like I said, having family on one side, friends on the other, I realize how much nuance there is. I think a lot of people don't appreciate how much nuance there is on both sides.
In what way? Because, like, the very black and white, one side versus the other, is You just go right down the line. Like, how do you feel about illegal immigration, same-sex marriage, abortion? Right. You know, do you like Jesus, son? And then you've got, like, sort of the others.
Well, I mean, even, like, for all the people who think conservatives are so monolithic, just look what's happening. I mean, real conservatives are really pissed off about this Trump thing. I mean, they kind of feel like they're, like, my dad is super conservative, Rush Limbaugh, Ann Coulter, Charles Krauthammer. These are, like, people. But even he's like, yeah, Rush Limbaugh's starting to, he's getting too angry for me even sometimes. And like, and he hates Trump with a passion. Like a year ago, I remember he, because like we sometimes like we'll have, like we never get heated or anything, but we sometimes argue over stuff like in a good constructive way. But like, just to mess with me, he's like, yeah, I think I'm going to go for Trump this round. And I was just like, I just started laughing. He's like, oh man, I thought I'd fool you. I was like, Dad, I know you're not that dumb. But like now I do have like people in my family that are like, even like, I mean, I figured they might be willing to vote for Trump just to go against Hillary because they hate Hillary. Yeah. But like some of them are actually pro Trump, just like among everybody. And I was like, what? And even my dad's like, yeah, I don't get it.
It's, I mean, I like these sorts of things being, what's the word, like exposed to, if you just looked at you on paper objectively, like a military kid with a father who's very conservative.
Well, he started out liberal when he was young, though. He was a big pot-smoking, Vietnam-protesting hippie.
That's what they always say, like, a young conservative has no heart and an old liberal has no brain or something like that. And then for you to list off your favorite people, it would seem to be diametrically opposed to your father.
Yeah.
And yet you guys can have conversations that are not heated, that are very like, I see your point.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are times, though, where I can see he gets a little like, because my dad's just very mellow. He's not a guy who loses his temper much. But there are times where I can see he's a little clenched teeth. He's like, well, that's bullshit. You know, but
he's always cool about it. How did the switch happen? Just owning a house, paying taxes, that sort of thing?
Yeah. I think, like, I mean, I think he was, well, because I've been thinking about this more, too. He was born in 54, so he wouldn't have been, like, of age, really, in the heart of Vietnam. So he would have been coming at the end of it. So he was probably just a kid kind of seeing what was on TV and stuff. And by the time he came of age, it was probably, the party was almost over anyway.
Oh, sure.
And so you're kind of in that cusp, and the 70s were shit. Like, the 70s sucked. Like,
don't you say that, man. Starship.
So it wasn't, like, a good time, you know, and I'm sure, like, I'm sure a lot of people just thought Jimmy Carter was like, this is what happens when you go outside the box. Get back in the box. Like, so yeah, I think Reagan turned, like, he was a Reagan guy. Or, like, by the end of Reagan, I think he was starting to be like, okay, I think this makes more sense. And, yeah, especially, like, you know, you're a guy with a family and a house and a job.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think I sometimes feel like when it comes to, like, the radical liberals, like the ones that are still teaching at college, it's like, yeah, but you can. You're a professor at a college, or if you're a celebrity, it's like, yeah, you can be radically liberal and still make money. I think for everybody else, it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
It's like, this isn't their job.
Yeah. So does some of his thoughts, like, they must impact you. They must, like, not just logically, but also out of, like, yeah, I love my dad.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I mean, yeah, I always give... I mean, I don't know. It's nice to just sort of like understand, because I still may wildly disagree with a lot of his stuff. What I've noticed, especially with my family, is like there seems to be more of the extremism coming in reference to the way people look at the opposition than in their actual principles. Like, I feel like most liberals can have nuance in their principles and like what they believe is okay. Same thing with conservatives. But what they think of the opposing side is always kind of extreme to me. So it's like with my family, when we talk about like how we feel about immigration or about, you know, taxes or whatever, I may disagree with them, but it seems like a reasonable debate. It's like, okay, I see where you're coming from. But once they get started thinking, and this is what liberals do, I'm like, okay, you sound nuts. I don't even know who you're talking about. Yeah. I know liberals and they don't think like that. What are you crazy?
Well, that's why you said that you go where you get pushed, and yet politically you've kind of held... You've held up your... You
know, oh, yeah. No, not with that. I just meant in my life. Like,
yeah, I get you. But I think that, like, your ability to interact with that side of your family is not... It's not a rarity. I'm sure there are a lot of people between these two generations ago. That's exactly how it is with me. That's exactly how it is with my family. I love them. They're smart people. We don't see eye to eye. And then they'll say the thing about, like... My aunt is kind of that way. Like, she'll say, well, you know, these welfare people with eight kids from seven different people. Like, who are these people? I live in a place where there's plenty of welfare. It's so frustrating to be like, you live in a tiny town. You don't see these people on the news. They show this, like, okay, great. That's so far off. So we're probably not that different in that, one, I don't have that many conversations politically, like, with my family. But, yeah, I mean, you're... That's
I mean, that's like, that's kind of what we talk about. I mean, but they're also fun. Like, I mean, they're fun people to hang out with. So it's either joking around or it's talking about politics. But honestly, it's only certain ones that I really, like my dad and I are probably the best at talking politics without it getting heated or anything, or like, you know.
How, I mean, is he religious?
No. I mean, he gives a lot of respect to religion. But I mean, he's never really been religious.
I think it would get heated if you have a vested, very, very passionate belief that someone is ignoring.
Yeah. And I mean, but I think for him, conservatism is a passionate belief. Like politics, I don't see it very different than religion. Because I mean, the thing of it is, it's nuts to say that there is a right or wrong answer to any of these questions. Mm-hmm. It's like you're giving it your best shot. Like those numbers, you can use this. Like a friend of mine once showed me, like way back in the day, Rush Limbaugh and Al Franken, like in their books, using the exact same statistics to prove two completely different points.
Funny. Yeah.
And it's like, that's the way it is. Like these numbers, everybody's like, it's like, I can show you some numbers. It's like, I'm sure you can. Like friends say that to me all the time when I say like, well, I'm kind of like sketchy about this. It's like, listen, I can show you some numbers. I'm like, I bet you can. I guarantee you can show me some numbers that'll prove you right. But that's not the point. I mean, at the end of the day, we're kind of taking our best guess. And I mean, really, you have to study the numbers yourself.
Yeah.
To really understand those numbers, it's going to take a lot of work. Like McRae has that joke about vaccines where somebody's like, what was he? He's talking about the experts, but it's just like, oh, I thought you by expert you meant you actually went to medical school, got a degree, and studied the information so that you could know. I didn't know by expert you meant read mommy blogs. and I feel like some people are, it's like you realize that if you really wanted to understand this issue, you would have to be studying it 24/7 for like a year straight, and then you might be able to give me a really good educated answer.
Yeah.
And it's like, and that's not what most people do. Most people read one article and they're like, I think I got it. It's like,
yeah, completely.
So it's like, and I'm not saying people shouldn't have opinions. It's just have humility along with your opinions, because there's no way you can know for sure. With history, I change my mind all the time about the presidents. Like, you may talk to me a year ago and I'll be like, yeah, I like Washington because this. And then you talk to me next year, he's like, Washington, not so great. Okay, you know, but I mean, I'm not saying that's how I feel about Washington, but I'm just saying, like, it does change all the time.
Well, that I want to get into that more, because that's where I feel like it's just so fascinating, like, your knowledge and that you keep churning it over and finding new bits and you're the passionate about it. It's so strange to me. But I really like it, because I think about the presidents from time to time. I'm sure I could just click and find something, and I go, I guess I'll never know that.
Well, that's how I feel when you talk about your science shit. Like, I mean, I just can't wrap my head around a lot of like science stuff. Like, that's the one class in school right now is like, and I'm taking the science that like is supposed to be like, I can tell it's for the stupid kids. I'm taking the stupid kid science class, and I'm like over a decade older than all of them, and I'm like, I don't get it.
All right, man. Well, let's get into it when we meet again. Okay. And we haven't even gotten into how much stuff he genuinely knows. Next week, you'll see. We'll get further into it. And it even involves some questions from you guys via Twitter and things like that, and really test his knowledge. And I make some flubs, so I hope you won't judge me too harshly on my lack of knowledge about American history. But I've anyway, so part two next week. Make sure to follow on Twitter. Sometimes I give out free stickers and things like that. And if we do have, or if I do have questions for the guests, that's where I go with them. So thanks to those of you who do follow the show and can chime in and add some questions. And again, thanks to L. Charlie Bishop for donating. Thanks to everyone who has donated and subscribed and rated the show and all those little metrics things that help. Shows coming up in Portland, Oregon as part of the Bridgetown Festival. Also going to be at Lestat's in San Diego ahead of that on the 31st. That's a free show. And then at the end of June, I will be at Acme in Minneapolis, the best place. So I hope you come out for that. And I'll be posting some dates before that of like a little mini tour through the Midwest ramping up to that. So that is it. Enjoy your week. Drink good beer. Listen to good music. This is a song from a band that, this is kind of older, but they were based out of the Bay Area, San Francisco band, I believe, that I've been listening to their record a lot, thanks to Mexican Summer, who sent some music when I mentioned I liked one of their bands and would like to hear some more music. And they're like, here, sent a bunch of albums, so thanks to them. Just nice folks all around. Everyone involved with the podcast, just nice people. And so, this is the Fresh and Onlys. If you haven't heard of them,
please look into them. This is off the album Long Slow Dance, and this is called Foolish Person. Thanks for stopping by the Space Cave. Into a prison where betrayals pay the ultimate price. I don't want to be a stupid person. You know that I have been a fool, been a fool all my life. You call me a fool once, but you could not say it at the door. I don't want to be a foolish person. You know that I have played a fool.